Our next speaker today is going to be Brian Spiraza from Foth Environment and Infrastructure, and he's going to, I think he's all wired up now and ready to talk to us on hydrogeologic characterization of fractured bedrock at a potential mine, at potential mine sites. Brian?
Hi, Steve. Thanks for inviting me to the conference here today. Can you, everyone hear okay? So today I'll be talking about, as Steve said, hydrogeologic characterization. And I'll be focusing on primarily the methods of characterization that were employed at some mine sites in the Midwest here in Minnesota. And not as much focusing on the specifics as Ernie said. If I say anything, it's a lie. So I'm going to just an overview here. Why are we interested in doing this? And then getting into how some of this is done. And this is really the methods and some of the results we observed. So why do we want to do it? Primarily, we want to understand some operational considerations of the mine, water control, potential mine inflows, and then also for permitting purposes, such as MPDS permits and appropriation permits. So how are we doing this? Well, our objective is to find, to locate and characterize the hydraulic and chemical aspects of flowing features. So I have flowing in quotes there because I don't want to get the wrong idea here. The velocities we're talking about are in the magnitudes of silts and clays, or possibly at best tills. And features, I'm making that generic to describe cracks or fractures without trying to say anything about how those were formed, what kind of stress strain mechanisms were in place that caused that, whether it be faulting or jointing or rebound, etc. So we take it a phased approach. Basically, the first step being getting a bunch of data from the company who's interested in this analysis, reducing their data, and developing statistical criteria that helps us wean out which boreholes we want to focus on and which ones we wouldn't. Then we go out and do some pre-screening, geophysical and hydrophysical surveys, or production logging, also referred to as. And then after that step, we'll have identified specific discrete intervals within the boreholes that we want to do some testing, so we use an inflatable packer assembly to do that. And then we go ahead with the testing and sampling. So the first step is to reduce all this data and try and create a higher probability of locating your flowing features. And so we're looking at geologic logs, geotechnical logs, and we develop our criteria, and it's similar to what you might go through for a sample selection process for acid rock drainage samples when you're looking at several hundred boreholes, tens of thousands of meters even of core, and based on rock types or structures or rock quality designation, you try and select a representative sample set. So we're doing a similar thing here. After you go through that process, you would select just a few boreholes, several boreholes from the pool for testing. And obviously, it probably would like to do, a company may like to do this on all the boreholes, but it is, a specialty work. Just to give an order of magnitude sense, for conducting these types of tests in around 5,000 linear feet, of borehole, the cost would range in the $150,000 range. So this is just to give you a sense of what the site looks like and what your work trying to get the boots on the ground, as we say. Give you an idea. This is a diamond core drill rig. These are mounted on low ground pressure vehicles to get into some softer areas. This is just to give you a sense of the coring drilling process, and a diamond-studded drill bit is mounted on a drill string, cuts the core from the parent material, and then a barrel assembly is lowered in to extract that core. And to help bring that home a little bit, I brought some diamond-studded core bits and a few of them, an HQ, NQ, and BQ. And all these have different, you'll use these for different purposes, depths. They're typically depth-limited, HQ being around 500 to 1,000 feet, NQ 1,000 to 1,500, and BQ 1,500 to 2,000 feet. And depending on rock densities, it might be able to go deeper. And then What you end up with is, after you're extracting your core, geologists would log these core trays. You're looking at about 100 feet of core right there. Part of that is sampled for the state. And so as as Jennifer had mentioned, do it for some analysis that they may do independently. And I did bring some of that as well, some not from a particular from any mining project, actually, but from previous experience I had working on conducting similar programs for actually environmental sites, doing bedrock characterization programs. But so this is a HQ core. And feel free during lunch if you'd like to come take a look at any of this. So after reducing all this data from the geotechnical logging, this is one parameter that we look at. What you're seeing here is rock quality designation, which gives you a sense of fracture density. And as it decreases, that's telling you that there's an increase in fracture density. So you see a decrease in RQD, and that represents an increase in fracture density. The colors represent different rock types, so you can actually get a sense of, okay, where is their what is the relative distribution of fracturing within different rock types. So that can help you wean out which boreholes you would want to select for testing and which ones may not be as preferable. So at this point, we have our, you know, we went from maybe 100 or 200 or 300 boreholes to 3, 4, 5, 6 to a handful. And we're ready to go out and do some pre-screening, which would include geophysical surveys and production logging. So that would be the second phase of work. The geophysical surveys include the OBI, or optical borehole imager, optical televiewer, it's also been called. And that's an oriented tool. It has an onboard magnetometer and inclinometer, so you can get a sense of your orientation of any structures you encounter while you're surveying. Caliper log, most are familiar with captures diameter. And the sonic and density logs can be used together to provide some an estimate of strength parameters of the rock, which can be helpful in selecting potential mining methods. As I said before, this also the second phase includes hydrophysical surveying, or also called production logging, again, to locate flowing features and estimate flow rate. So there's different methods of doing this. The one you select is typically dependent on what kind of flows you're anticipating. So and since we're anticipating low flows in these situations and confirm that, we went with a tracer method that actually is an emplacement method where we emplace low conductivity water, deionized water, and then do conductivity surveys to track changes in conductivity with time, which give you an indication, one, of where along that borehole length you're seeing flow into the borehole, and two, a rough estimate of what the magnitude of that flow could be. So here's a setup logging truck doing those surveys. That's what it looks like on the ground. Here's the tools that we just discussed. And this is the conductivity temperature probe that's used for the production logging. Just a shot there of the probe itself. And so what this represents is this initial conductivity survey log, where before we did any emplacement, we just wanted to see what the ambient conditions of the fluid column were. So that FEC is a fluid electrical conductivity, and then temperature you see. And this one was around 1,600 feet deep. So you get a sense of what that looks like. And this can give you an initial sense if there's any breakout zones that are highly distinct, even in ambient flow conditions. So this is then doing the emplacement, placing deionized water into the borehole. And we're monitoring conductivity at the surface, waiting for basically that ambient conductivity water to be replaced by nearly zero conductivity water, at which point the meter would read very low conductivity. And this is what your production log looks like after that. So as you can see, it flatlined to the left there on conductivity. That's what it looked like during, you know, immediately after emplacement. And then these logs were conducted from, these are in military time, 1635 to 1500. So over an hour and a half, those six different concentric lines were logged. And you can see that those spikes are growing with time, indicating that there is some type of there is a flowing feature at that location. The delta between those lines are modeled in a mass balance calc to give you an estimate of what that flow rate is. So that information helps us then, I'm going to go back, helps us then cite where we may want to do our inflatable Packer tests, and gives us a sense of what type of magnitude stress we might use for our hydraulic test, so that we can get these tests conducted in an appropriate time frame. So after all the production logging and geophysical logging is done, you get this summary plot like this. A lot of information on here. The first column of information is your inclinometer and magnetometer reading. So that's telling you how the borehole is trending with depth and how the dip is changing with depth. So the next column is your ambient conditions of conductivity and temperature. The third column there is your caliper log and an estimate of your flow in each of those intervals based on production logging. And the fourth column is actually just two of the conductivity logs from the logging scenario. Most interesting ones here to me here are the last two. What this is really showing you here is you see all these tadpoles, as they're called. They look like thumbtacks. And those tadpoles are digitized from the OBI image. So the geophysical engineer goes into that image, blows it up well beyond this, because this is highly compressed from, you know, we're looking at 1,200 feet of hole right here. So they would have maybe 40 feet per sheet. And that's why when you get these OBI surveys, it's a couple reams of paper. They go in and digitize each of these features that to give you a attitude of those fractures. The direction that those tadpoles are pointed give you, that's a dip direction. The color of the tadpole is telling you what the estimated aperture of that fracture was. So that's every single fracture encounter there, is that second to last column. The ones on the right are the ones that actually had measurable flow. So what this gives you a sense of here is that, you know, although you have an enormous number of fractures with widely variable orientation, you have only a few, likely less than 5% of your total features actually have any flow component. And so these next slides are are basically additional representations of those data sets. So once you get this data, you can start to play around and do your analysis and try and run some statistics on what you're observing. This is the breakdown of what these tadpoles mean in terms of aperture, basically just in terms of aperture. So what we saw was, you know, those top couple or three, so either healed fractures or a continuous fracture, but we didn't see really any with much aperture to them. So these are very, you know, small cracks is the takeaway there. This is more along the scale of how the geophysical engineer would be looking at this information, is looking at one sheet here at a time and digitizing the orientation of these fractures. And that sinusoid, well, some of them are sinusoid, some of them look like a straight line, are proportional to the angle that plane is cutting the borehole. So depending on that angle is telling you what the attitude and of that feature is, so they can back calculate that out because they have this tool is oriented. The color of those lines again is related to the aperture observed, and the blue rectangle is the flow observed over that interval. And then you see a couple of rose diagrams to the right that are giving you orientations of those features. So giving you a sense, is there any preference to how these are oriented or not, either in dip or in azimuth. And these intervals, you know, this particular one happened over about 5 feet. There's others that are 15 feet, and there's others that are less than a foot, where everything's happening in very distinct, discrete features. Here's this called a walkout plot. If this was a vertical borehole, it would just be a point. But because there is walkout and azimuth and dip to these, you see this change in northern yeasting as you go in depth with the borehole. Some more, you know, statistical analysis saying, you know, what is the frequency of occurrence of a particular dip direction? You know, it looks like this particular borehole had the preference was roughly southeast, you would say. The dip angle for this particular borehole, maybe there isn't much preference to it of these features. And using a stereo net analysis to kind of tell you similar information, whether these, you know, whether there's preference to this or not, is just another representation in a stereo net. So at this point, we have, you know, reduced all the data, selected our boreholes from several hundred, done the pre-screening geophysical and hydrophysical surveys, and so now we've selected the specific intervals we want to test because of the what we found learned from the hydrophysics and production logging, and we're going to go out with a inflatable packer assembly and do some direct hydraulic testing. So packer assembly, these are the steps kind of involved from this point forward. The packer assembly, you can run a wireline packer or a drill pipe packer. I'll get into that a little bit in a minute on the next slide. These are typically custom built. A few projects I've worked on with these, because these boreholes are so small, you have to get into some custom machinery. And the off-the-shelf stuff is around $2,000, $3,000, $4,000. The custom designs are around $20,000. Some of the terminology you run into when you're working with the manufacturer on a design, you know, this injection zone, what your transfer tubes and pressure transducer configuration is going to look like. After you finally get your packer all set up how it needs to be for your specific site, and designed accordingly, you're ready to go out and do hydraulic testing, and this can range. There's many types of tests available to you, and depending on the, you know, condition you're in or what you're observing in hydrophysics, you want to keep as much flexibility basically open as possible to yourself, so that needs to be played into your design as well. Sampling's conducted with airlifts or pumping. But again, you have very small diameters, so you have to think about what types of pumps are capable and what type of depths of head you're fighting against to bring your samples up. And finally, and once we are out of the field with all this information, we do analysis and modeling. And there's different types, you know, conventional modeling being, you know, Cooper-Jacob or Hantoush analysis. There's also pressure derivative analysis, and more recently developed, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000, Perez analysis and Echenoux analysis. And then we take our chemistry data to do some typing and standards comparison to see how that would fit for any potential future permitting activity. So this is, again, just, I guess, a bunch of inputs that go into your packer considerations, your custom design. What you're going to need, the steps required to make, and considerations to make sure you can meet all of the test intervals you've selected. So you're sometimes doing this real time while you're out in the field getting your hydrophysics. You're learning where you're actually going to want to conduct your tests, but you're also working on your lead time with your custom packer, which can take a little bit. So you're got to be kind of processing some of that real time so you can make smart decisions for your packer design. So this is a conceptual drawing from a USGS paper of what a packer, this would actually be a drop pipe type packer. And what makes a drop pipe packer is that it sits, that top packer, the one in black, sits inside of the drill casing drop pipe. And that actually, the drop pipe of the drill casing actually acts as your tool that's lowering this packer up and down the hole. The two red packers would be your straddle zone. So between those two packers is where you're actually conducting your test or pulling your sample. So that's what those blue squares represent, kind of indicating, well, this is where your test zone is. So again, working with the manufacturer would determine whether that interval is set or whether you're going to make it modular so that you can adjust it depending on the intervals you observe during production logging. So here's One of the designs I worked with manufacturer, this is a drop pipe packer. This is his. This was our final design. And so you can see the drop pipes going up the side there. There's a packer that's set inside of the drop pipe. There were centralizers installed on that to keep it in the center of the borehole and drill pipe because these holes are angled. That's important. In drawing these and working over the phone so much, you lose track of what you're talking about. And this $20,000 piece of equipment that you're gonna, even actually in some cases drop down this, you're talking about a 2-inch, two inch diameter. It's just amazing the scale when you step back for a second and realize the scale that you're actually talking about. And this is actually this is the injection zone, as it's called, or this test interval. I'll use the laser right here. That's what this is. So all of your sampling and your testing is being conducted through that slot right there, which is, again, the scale. This is a wireline packer. As it sounds, instead of using drop pipe to raise and lower your packer, you're just using the wireline that's on the rig or geophysical vehicle to raise and lower, which offers its time advantages over a drop pipe system. As you know, maybe tripping drill pipe a couple thousand feet is a lot longer than hitting a button and reeling up a wire line. So there's some time gain there. And this is showing how the intended design for where your transducers will sit, your pressure transducers will sit. Maybe that's a good point here is that your pressure transducers are where you're going to, for hydraulic testing, you're going to extract your heads, your change in heads and pressure from those transducers. You want to have one in your test interval that's showing what's happening in the test interval, but you also want to have transducers above and or below the packer zone so that you can test for potential bypass through the packer zone. So if potentially the packer were to fail, the transducer would indicate that. When you applied your stress during the test, you would see an inflection in your transducer record for those outside intervals. Something that we've also noticed during some of this testing, though, is that you may have an inflection, but it can be very slow, which you would interpret as a bypass through your formation, which, it's... So sometimes, we react adversely to some inflection that we see during testing, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's saying, hey, this means that this fracture can be connected outside of your test zone, and that's okay. That's telling you something. That's telling you about the continuity or the extent of these fractures, which is important. Another thing that we're seeing, have observed too, is when we're doing some of these tests, you're applying that pressure through a drop pipe that's going, in this case, a poly drop pipe that's going to the top of the packer. Now, that pipe might vibrate a little bit when you're performing your stress, so you might observe that in your upper transducer above the packer. Again, so something that initially you think you have an adverse reaction to seeing that inflection, but stepping it through, you might be able to say that, oh, that's actually an artifact of the test or of the formation itself. Here's a picture of what these packers actually look like. The drillers were like on Christmas Day here. And this is about the element itself that expands is about 3 feet long. And here's this one was a drop pipe packer system. So what you're seeing here is the top packer there is what would sit in the drop pipe. And then you have your adapters that are going to convey your inflation lines and transfer tubes for pressure measurement down through this packer. This is that the beginning of that injection zone, which I was showing you here. All in all, it ended up being after we put there some more pictures of this, of all the hardware involved. And this is the bottom of it, of the assembly, the bottom packer being here. So this would represent the straddle zone, which was a 20-foot zone for this packer. And so all in all, it was 30-something feet tall, so it was nice to have the drill mast to help us operate that. As you can see, it's being so small, it can be a little clumsy to handle. Here's some of the support equipment required, inflation lines, water tank, regulators, etc. So we take all this, after doing all this testing, bring this back into the office and start our analysis. And the top plot is just the test record. So we're seeing all these inflections representing, you know, moving the packer or inflating the packer. The way we conducted this test is we airlifted a slug of water out of the test interval. So you see this drop down represents the airlift of water out, and then our subsequent recovery. This graph is just telling you what was the setup for this test. For this particular test, we left the bottom packer deflated and only inflated the top packer. This is a conventional analysis showing what our recovery was with pressure. And then these are these derivative analysis for, and here we are, for these pressures, also providing estimates of transmissivity, hydraulic conductivity, storativity. I think I am. So the results of this test, of these surveys, of these various phases, was that, yeah, there was about 7,000 features, flowing and non-flowing. There was a semi-dominant southeast trend, non-dominant dip. Of those 7,000, there was about 40 that had flow components, had a similar attitude. And the flows that were estimated from the production logging were indicating somewhere around silts or tills. When we went out and did some direct hydraulic testing, tested four of those features, and ended up with modeled conductivities in the ranges of silts and clays. As far as water quality sampling, we basically identified that the type was distinct from the deep bedrock water was distinct from the surface water system as far as a water type, although it was below standards for all considerations.
Questions for Brian?
Well, really, you need the production logging for that. You need to do some form of production logging to identify what's flowing. If knowing that you have a fracture isn't enough in telling you if it's flowing or not. So tell the viewers is a picture. It's a picture of the borehole, and it's not telling you if there's something necessarily flowing there or not. So we have used the heat pulse and this emplacement method for testing, and so far the emplacement method's been good for us. Eventually, I mean, I think eventually it would play into reporting for the state of Minnesota. At this point, in this phase of work, no. During this time, at this point, no.